Welcome to another episode of Fucan Conversation. Today I have Vidya Shah from York University. She's an assistant prof who works on addressing systemic inequities, whether that's at her university, at York University, or in partnership with local school boards. So I'm so excited. Vidya, prior to the podcast, sent me a few articles, and I've got so many questions for her today. Looking so forward to catching up and talking to you, Vidya. So how are you doing, Vidya?
I'm doing well, Nick. Thanks so much for having me on the podcast. I'm really excited to be here.
So how are things? I know you're in Toronto right now. So what's it like living in Toronto, whether that's in relation to your work at York University or just being in the largest city in Canada?
Yeah, you know, it's, of course, like everyone in Canada, very, very different times. I can speak from my particular experience that it has been a time of much more opportunities for deep self-reflection and for thinking about how we are all connected to something much larger than just ourselves and what that means in terms of how we act in this moment, how we relate to one another in this moment. So I've been doing a lot of that thinking recently. And primarily because when you think about the families and the students that are attending schools in the GTA, their contexts are so different. And we often, you know, don't see that. And so, just being in contact with people that are with teachers, with school board leaders, with folks in the community that are working directly with families and students, I feel like I can be in the loop to some degree and be connected to some degree to what's happening. And being connected with families and educators that I know, you know, and just getting a sense of what's happening out there. And so there's such varied realities that people are experiencing right now. And I keep thinking about how do we center folks who are being disproportionately disadvantaged right now.
Well, I know I saw, you know, initially when the Ontario government started mandating different emergency initiatives as part of the Emergency Act for Ontario, part of it was asking parents to keep students at home, so students and teachers stay at home, but at the same time, ensuring to the public that, you know, schools to some degree were going to continue, quote unquote, as usual. And to do so that they were shifting to learning online at home. And I've seen you've been really active on in terms of social media and some of the blogs that you've written addressing and reminding whether it's politicians or school board administrators and the public that not everyone has the same access to the necessary resources to do work from home. And I was just wondering if you could comment on how you've been collaborating either with school boards at this present time or even thinking about that in relation to your research at York University.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Nick, I think part of it is that we have to ask ourselves at this time, you know, who is more likely to be infected by COVID-19 and who is being disproportionately impacted? And so a lot of the conversations that I'm having with folks in school boards, with teachers and educators at large, with families, with folks working with families, is in relation to these questions. And we are in conversation about who those populations are. And there's this rhetoric right now that the risk is the same for everyone and that every child or every family is going to experience this in similar ways. And, you know, while the actual virus itself may not discriminate, the political and economic structures that have long been in place in Canadian history and globally, you know, with roots of oppression and dispossession, cultural genocide, erasure, you know, we think about that this has been our history and that this is our present. Inevitably, this virus is going to disproportionately impact particular communities. So we've been, you know, I'm thinking about Indigenous communities that are under boil water advisories, with housing shortages, with, you know, failing healthcare infrastructures. I think about students whose families are marginalized by low income, who might not have a quiet place to learn, who might not have access to a device, or, you know, there's one family sharing one device and you have four students. So all of a sudden learning at home becomes quite you know, nearly impossible. There are some families with no access to Wi-Fi, and, you know, families that are struggling with food insecurity or job loss. There's unprecedented job loss right now. And so when we think about all these factors, e-learning or learning, teacher-led online learning becomes very different in each context and almost impossible for some children. And so how does that impact when we think about achievement and opportunity gaps and we think about access to equity? All of these inequities that have always existed are now being exacerbated. And yes, we are holding back on, EQAO tests. That's not going to happen this year. And yes, there are any marks that are collected at this point will increase a student's mark, but not necessarily decrease a student's mark. But even that, like, that contributes to increasing gaps between various populations. And of course, you know, we know that with organizations like the Color of Poverty or the Urban Alliance for Race Relations, CAMH is doing a lot of work on this, the Ontario Human Rights Commission, that there is a color to poverty. Poverty is heavily racialized. And, you know, when we think about who are the frontline workers, when we think about who is working at grocery stores, who's delivering parcels, who's in pharmacies, who's in, you know, who's working in long-term healthcare facilities or hospitals, who are the farmers? Many of whom are migrant or temporary workers. What are the identities of these people, and who are the students, and who are the children, and how are the children being impacted by this? You know, I think about you and I, for example. We can afford to work from home. You know, I've transferred my office to my home. I can go on walks daily, you know, for exercise and to support my mental health. If I need access to a therapist online, I have one because I still have benefits. I'm still getting paid, you know, but I think about how different other realities are right now and how are we centering those realities in this conversation. There are some school boards that are giving out a gift card from the school district to buy groceries that week. Like, we are living in very, very different realities. There was an excellent article that came out on April 3rd in the Halifax Examiner by somebody named Elle Jones. And Elle writes that Black women are concentrated in frontline healthcare. The agriculture industry employs large numbers of Black migrants who are affected by border closures. There's new state of emergency declarations raise concerns about the intensification of racial profiling directed at Black communities. Black people make up a disproportionate amount of precarious work. People in the gig economy and home businesses such as hairdressing, prisons, known as an epicenter of infections, disproportionately incarcerate Black people. The socioeconomic impact of health means that COVID-19 will have a serious impact on Black communities and seniors. And so this idea that we are all impacted similarly is simply false. And I see it playing out in how we are thinking about educating our students right now and how we are thinking about what learning and schooling means. We don't have a clear enough picture. We don't have a big enough picture of the various realities that are at play right now. And because we don't have that big enough picture, we can't possibly center students that are most marginalized.
In your work, you outline some of the research that you've done working with leadership who are committed to social justice, and they're looking at it through a lens of how they self-identify and whether they're racially privileged or not as leaders. And I wonder how are you thinking in relation to your own research about acknowledging our privilege and questioning it, but then trying to do something about it in relation to the current context that we find ourselves in. So I don't, you know, I'm thinking about some of the school principals that say, hey, I recognize that I'm white and I'm privileged and I'm trying to serve my communities differently on the one hand. And on the other hand, in terms of what you pointed out about how different communities who have historically been marginalized in relation to, you know, a settler colonial system, you know, the calls, for example, in the media to asking the chief health officer, why aren't we recording race-based data in relation to the impacts of COVID-19? There's a resistance, or maybe the communication that there's not a capacity or it's not necessary to do that kind of data gathering, so we might understand who's being impacted the most. So I'm just wondering, you know, what is it or that leaders should be thinking about in terms of those that acknowledge that they have privilege on the one hand, and then on the other saying that they'd like to do more to serve the communities that do not necessarily have the same equitable access to the resources or privileges that they do.
Yeah, that's such a great question, Nick. You know, I think about this in the context of anti-racism, whiteness, and white supremacy. And, you know, one of the things that whiteness does is that it there's an unwillingness to name like the contours of racism. There's an avoidance to identifying with a racialized group or racialized experience. There's a normalization of whiteness against which all other races are constructed. And so what that means is that when we think about who our students are and what their experiences are, and we have a largely white teaching staff in relation to the students in our school systems, what does that mean in terms of how we are understanding their lived realities, how we are thinking about the ways in which life is impacted, is being impacted? And therefore, how are we thinking about what success means? How are we thinking about what failure means? How are we thinking about what learning means? How are we thinking about what access and opportunity mean? These questions come to mind when we recognize that whiteness is, you know, is constructed to invisibilize difference, invisibilize itself and construct difference in relation to that. And so when I think about principals that are doing this work, you know, there have been efforts to reach out and talk, you know, send packages home for students that don't have access to Wi-Fi or students that don't have access to a device. And you know, there have been some shifts made on the part of school boards and on the part of individual teachers to support students. But I also think about the importance of relationships here. You know, for classroom teachers, for educators that have built strong relationships with students and families, this transition is probably going to be somewhat easier. And for those, you know, in those cases, reaching out and asking students, what's happening? What's going on? How are you feeling? You know, there are so many teachers that I've spoken to when they reach out to students and ask the students, what do you want? The response is, I just want you to check in on me and see how I'm doing. And that says so much, that there is this relationship of trust, this relationship of care, one of love, that the student feels seen by the teacher. And that is such an important part of what is happening right now, you know, and so we have to think about and question, how do we center relationships? How do we center learning versus schooling? You know, learning happening everywhere all the time, honoring what's happening in our students' homes, honoring the learning that has always taken place and that continues to take place when mom or grandma or auntie is cooking, when we're having conversations about something we're seeing on TV, if we're outside or if we're in the apartment building, you know, all of those conversations, that is learning. And so to really, as educators and for parents, to really honor, you know, what is happening there and what is the learning that's actually taking place that for a long time has not been quantified in formal schooling processes that are heavily influenced by settler, white, colonial, male, able-bodied, cis, hetero structures. And so part of this moment and part of this time for us as educators, as leaders, is to recognize the ways in which these systems have limited other knowledge systems, to recognize the ways in which education and schooling have maintained hegemonic knowledge structures at the expense of Indigenous knowledge systems and other ways of knowing and being, is to recognize the fact that we can come together and imagine some future possibilities in terms of what life might be like, what school might be like, what our classroom might be like when we come back together physically. And so, you know, there's this moment that we are being presented with, to not only rush to try to make sense of what do I do in these next couple of weeks? How do I, you know, fill learning gaps? How do I make sure that, you know, we are being productive, that we are accounting for ourselves as educators, and that, you know, maybe that's not the approach that we need to be taking right now. There is a global pause happening. And in that pause, what if we were to question the very systems and structures on which our schools have been built, that have sorted students, that have stratified students, that have excluded students, that have harmed students? What if now is an opportunity to say, what do we need to do to let go of those structures that we have thought have been impossible to let go of for some people and have been intentionally kept in place by others? What do we need to do now to let go of those structures? Because inevitably we're seeing an exacerbation of inequities happening right now across the board for young people. So now is a time to say, what are these structures? How do we let go of them? How do we make space for new structures? And to be vigilant about that as educators, as activists, as people doing this work, how do we be vigilant about keeping an eye out for the ways in which capitalism and white supremacy and settler colonialism are going to creep back in and find new ways of operating in this quote unquote time of crisis? So we have to guard against that as leaders in the system. We have to think about, you know, what is the purpose of education? Why are we here? Who are our students? What are their needs? What are their dreams? What are their aspirations? And centering that in the conversation. And you brought up a really important piece, Nick, about identity-based data. And that's something that I've been really interested in and really vocal about for a while, because if we don't have this data, and in particular race-based data, we cannot identify the problems that exist. We can't give them name, we can't give them voice, we can't give them power. And it is, you know, when you can't, it's so easy to dismiss experience, to dismiss voice as the one-off experience. But when you see it in numbers and you see it in patterns and you see it historically over time, it creates a different perspective, and it creates political will to have to do something about it. We are held to account. There is a definite piece here that, you know, what it does is it holds school boards to account to change the historical patterns of exclusion and marginalization and racialization. And I think about what's happening now. We anecdotally know, and many people in actuality know, that there are particular populations who are being disproportionately disadvantaged by COVID. And we know that that's happening in schools as well. But without race-based data, without sociodemographic data, in both healthcare and in education, we are not going to be able to name those realities to give them any voice. And that's on purpose. You know, folks in power, to maintain white supremacy, to maintain patriarchy, to maintain capitalism, this data is dangerous. And it threatens the very basis upon which the invisibility operates to keep those systems of oppression in place. It just goes to show that we cannot address the impact, the disproportionate impact of COVID on vulnerable communities and on racialized and marginalized students in our schools if we don't have this data.
So collectively, and being able to understand collectively in terms of how different communities are impacted in relation to the data, then gives more power to communities to advocate to policymakers to address those inequities. And I was just wondering, so there, on the one hand, there's the identity in relation to the way in which one's racialized, and then how that's embedded for you individually within a system that's propped it up by white supremacy and settler colonialism. And I'm wondering, you know, the work that you do in relation to social justice and critical pedagogy, and more specifically with socially engaged Buddhism, I was wondering if you could clarify a little bit in terms of what you just said in relation to your own work on socially engaged Buddhism in terms of what you state is for equity activists and scholars to disidentify from these identities, which is significant to transformative practice in several ways. So first, disidentification allows for greater nuance, complexity, and ambiguity in the search for justice and liberation because we are less attached to our ideas and convictions. And second, as you state, less attachment increases the awareness of blind spots in our understanding of oppression. So on the one hand, there's a call for understanding identity and in relation to its impact in terms of systemic inequities. There's also, you're talking about in your work in terms of acknowledging one's privilege in relation to identity. But then you're also asking, whether it's teacher candidates or grad students through your work or even educational leaders, to learn how to disidentify from their identities. So I'm just wondering if you could speak a little bit. I don't know specifically if you're calling for others to do that work, but I know personally that this is the kind of work that you do. And I, you know, at the start, in terms of opening up and saying, during these times, it's been an opportunity for you to engage greater self-reflection. So I just, if you could speak a little bit to the concept of socially engaged Buddhism, I'd really appreciate that.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that was a piece I wrote called Calling in the Self, and it speaks to two very, you know, in the past, two very different parts of myself. And so one part is this, you know, deep sort of dive inward in terms of my own self, deep meditation, the practice of Vipassana meditation that has really served me in many, many ways. And my activism in the world and my voice in the world around issues of educational inequities. And there came a point where those two parts of me were living in one body, and but were not in communication. And it really felt like a tension that was causing internal, it just wasn't aligned. And it felt like it was causing sickness, actually. So at some point, they had to start speaking to each other. And what I started to ask myself was, you know, in what ways is the violence that lives in me perpetuating itself in the world? What is the relationship between the violence that lives in me and the violence that is in the world? I saw myself as sort of an extension of what was happening in the larger world. And I kept thinking to myself, you know, if there isn't this deep place of critical self-reflection in the work of equity and justice advocates, we will simply be replicating the very logics that we are fighting against. I think about folks who are very strong and bold, and there's a necessary power that comes from who they are and their voice in the world. And I also see that tempered with the need to create, you know, equity empires. And equity empires is this idea that, you know, there's going to be this equity emperor or empress, and there are followers, and there are, you know, this gathering of people that are going to rally around this person. And I think about how dangerous that is, because it's replicating colonial logics. It's even though I personally agree with that thinking, the very fact that we are seeing knowledge as final, as complete, and not recognizing the partiality of that knowledge is so detrimental to the actual act of engaging in ongoing critical pedagogies, decolonizing pedagogies that ask us to move and change and be in relation to the work that we're doing. So in addition to the knowledge not being final or static, we need to not be final and static, and we need to engage that differently. You know, I think about in this paper, I talk about the ways that I've had to come to terms with my own ego, you know, the ways in which my deep-seated fears and insecurities and the part of me that wants to be seen and to have influence and to be seen as intelligent, what are the slippery ways that that part of me operates in the work that I do? And what I've noticed that it does is it taints what's possible in the world. And it actually takes the, you know, even though I think I'm working towards systemic change, that I'm working towards institutional change. What I'm actually doing is playing out my own fears, my own insecurities. And that's taking precedence over the institutional change. And so it's this mind trap that we can find ourselves in as equity advocates, equity activists. So this idea of performing equity is another piece that I talk about, you know, and there's a lot of folks that, including myself, that will say, you know, drop the right term, or, you know, use the right equity activist name, or see themselves as an equity badass. And the attachment to that image of equity badass or equity scholar or equity activist or equity educator, the attachment to that image actually limits the work of greater justice in the world. And so what I have been practicing in myself, and what is an invitation to others, is how do we disidentify from that equity scholar, equity activist identity, so that we can make greater space for the work to actually happen? Because when somebody threatens that identity, I then go into my own stuff, and I'm not able to actually engage in the work of justice. And so in the practice of doing this work, the more that we can disidentify with ourselves in those particular ways, the more transformative this work can actually be. I think about when I was doing my doctoral work, it was on the Model Schools for Inner Cities program in the Toronto District School Board, a program in which I worked at that time. And a few times I had to stop writing because I couldn't grapple with the fact that I was getting a doctoral degree because people in the city and in the Toronto District School Board, families and students, were living in poverty, and that there was a racialization to that poverty. Like I was getting a degree because other people are being oppressed. I couldn't settle myself with that. I couldn't make sense of that. And so many of our jobs and our roles, when we think about it, exist because oppression exists. And that is a mind trip. And that is something that we have to grieve, like to sit with and really think about what that means. You know, there's a lot of sort of credentialing, there's a lot of careerism, there's a lot of all these things that happen in which equity becomes this marker of, you know, if I can drop these terms and if I can say these things, all of a sudden now I'm going to be promoted. And I think that's one of the dangers that we need to think about for you know, as equity reemerges as a central leadership quality, as something that we're thinking about more and more recently in education in particular ways. This is a danger that we need to be aware of.
So how are you negotiating that in relation to working now at a higher education institution and across not just Canada, but, you know, across the world, where universities, for the most part, are informed by, you know, a neoliberal philosophy of competition and rankings, and being asked to make sure that you try to publish your work in, you know, the top ranked peer reviewed journals, while at the same time ensuring that the university is out in community and doing the kind of work that you're calling for. So I'm just curious in terms of how you're negotiating on the one side, questioning the very structures that are in place that are creating these, you know, social, psychological, economic, material inequities for different people, but at the same time that the reliance in terms of trying to get tenure and promotion within that system that's calling on you to compete in certain ways. And I'm not saying you are personally, but it seems to me in my own lived experience in higher ed that within different elements or realms in terms of what counts as research or bringing in money to the university, that it often can counter kind of the social benefits that we're seeking to do in the work with community.
Oh, Nick, that's such a great question. it's been a struggle from day one for me. It's been something that has been on my mind. How do I engage this work as ethically and with as much integrity as I can? And so, you know, I first had to come to terms with the fact that I am now further entrenched in a settler colonial white supremacist space. I have to come to terms with that. And by virtue of the fact that I'm in this space, I'm complicit. That has always been the case. I mean, I was a classroom teacher prior. Education is a prime example of settler colonialism and white supremacy, capitalism, the works. So part of it is really just coming to terms with that. And I don't know that I can ever fully come to terms with that. I think if I do, I'm fooling myself, frankly. But starting there as a place and then asking myself, what can I do to divest from this? In what ways can I actively and willingly give up privileges that come with this? How can I be really aware of the ways in which these pieces are, you know, seeping into how people see me, how I see myself, what my role is in the world? And part of that is, you know, prior to being a professor, I was seconded. And prior to being seconded, I was a classroom teacher. And many of the views now I've had for a long time. And I was sharing this with you earlier that something magical happened 16 months ago where all of a sudden people think I'm way smarter all of a sudden because, you know, I now have this professor role. Nothing internally has actually changed. Yeah, I may have read a few more things. I may have thought about a few more things, but fundamentally not that much has changed. But externally, the impression is that, oh, wow, she must be so smart. And having to navigate how people are treating me differently, how people are talking to me differently, how people are respecting me differently, how people are validating my voice differently. I know that is completely caught up in neoliberal, white supremacist notions of what success and failure, meritocracy, all of these different pieces. So being aware of that, I have to ask myself, you know, I know that, you know, pre-tenureship is a certain amount of time. What can I do in that time? I know that I'm here for, you know, X number of years. What can I do in that time? And how do I think about how do I let go of what's going to happen after that?
Do you not think that perhaps that you say like the last 16 months, but could it not be that more people or different people that you necessarily didn't have the kinds of interactions with per se, your more kind of peripheral interactions, you're having more direct actions now and that your work's highly respected. So it's not necessarily, I mean, it could be in part the transition from a doctoral student to, seconded prof to tenure track prof, but maybe it's also about people really respecting the work that you're doing and the way in which you're working with community and a shift perhaps institutionally. I don't know if that's the case, but there might be perhaps a few people that are a little bit more open to the kind of things that you're calling for, whether that's at the school board level or at the university level. And I'm not saying you personally calling for, but in collaboration with the communities that you've always been working with and with them calling for certain things that maybe certain people now are open to listening to, but I'm not sure how much they're actually doing at the university level. I find at the University of Ottawa, more and more people are open to listening, but trying to get down into the nitty-gritty of trying to change the way we do things becomes a lot more difficult. So I don't know if that's the same for you.
Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely, you know, I mean, part of being at the university now means that I'm more visible. You know, what I say has a broader reach. It's not just within a school board. It's now within many school boards and beyond. And so there's a recognition that part of what comes with this is a willingness to hear and read about these ideas, not necessarily to implement them in the same ways. And so there's this, but there is also a greater willingness to implement these things in the same way. But, you know, part of the reason I name this is because examples, I think, of divesting in of whiteness, which operates in me as a South Asian person, is to think about, you know, there are folks in school boards that are really capable and brilliant and have contextual experience as to how to negotiate these things. And I think about this notion of deferring to, you know, an external quote unquote expert and what it means, how we can support schools and school boards in seeing and honing and recognizing and valuing the expertise that exists in their school boards. You know, I think about folks I've taken to social media in such a big way. And it's really since the Summer Institute in 2018, when my co-chair at the time told me that I had to get on. So I created a Twitter account, had no idea what that meant. And I've been fairly active on it since and have been using it as a platform to share ideas and to share perspectives. But also recognizing the ways in which collaboration and community can happen, the ways in which we can raise each other's voices up on social media, the ways in which we can honor the work of people who are doing fantastic work in community, in schools, in various locations, to take down the, to just challenge this, you know, omnipotence that academia has, and to actually use the greater access and the greater visibility that I have in this role to continue to shut my voice up and actually allow others who are doing the work to speak. So I think about that a lot, you know, like I think about the ethics of there are certain people who I would, you know, go to interview, and then all of a sudden I get a great publication in some, you know, fancy journal. But why not just give those people the voice and the space? Not that I can give them voice, but why not create the conditions for their voice to just be heard and to not necessarily benefit or profit off of their ideas? And so there's these constant negotiations of maybe I don't want to spend that much time trying to get into that particular journal. Maybe I want to spend more of my time on social media, building community, contributing to structures that are already in place that can further dialogue. Maybe that's how I want to spend my time. And so it's really about, in my mind, blurring the lines between scholar and activist and practitioner, and having been in multiple spaces, there's something very powerful about this notion of liminality, this in-betweenness that can exist when we blur the lines between who is considered the knowledge producer and who is considered the knowledge user and who is considered the knowledge mobilizer. What if we're all those things in different times, in different ways?
And how do you take that up now with your students in the classroom? So whether that's teacher education or grad school, I know I've got another course coming up this May. I've actually got two. One's a seminar research course in curriculum studies, which I'm looking forward to including these podcasts and your work. And the other one's an intro to curriculum studies. And when I teach the courses and we look at, and we start off right from the very start, acknowledging that we're all privileged in terms of the being able to work on the unceded ancestral territories of the Algonquin people as a part of a settler colonial system, and look at the ways in which we're implicated in that system, I often have students respond, perhaps not as much as before, but still have students respond that, you know, if I had known this was going to be an Indigenous studies course, I wouldn't have taken this course. Or why are we still studying about historical trauma, about something in the past, and not necessarily a capacity to recognize that there's an intergenerational relationship between settler colonialism and its history in relation to what we're experiencing today, as in terms of being privileged, and those communities that still have to boil their water to have clean water to be able to wash their hands during a COVID-19. So, in your work, you make reference to acknowledging privilege with educational leaders, and you've cited some work by Peggy McIntosh in terms of thinking about one's knapsack, or also D'Angelo's work in terms of white fragility. And I'm just wondering how you take that up with the students, that whether they self-identify or racialize as being white within the classroom, and how do you take that up in light of some scholars who are critical, like it's not my position to teach you about this history or historical trauma, that's your job to take that up, and for others, other scholars looking to work with whether it's teacher candidates or grad students or even you know, community leaders who see themselves as racially privileged, as trying to write a different kind of narratives or a different way of thinking or being that's more inclusive or works, as you say, to disidentify in terms of the identities that give them that privilege and the ways in which whiteness erases that. So I'm just wondering, how do you take these big kind of complicated concepts that have for many students, deeply personal and emotive connections to responding to one way or another. How are you taking those up with students?
Yeah, that's a great question. I see it in a couple of ways. The first is that, you know, there's the notion of whiteness as a racial discourse that needs to be understood, that needs to be named, that we need to reflect on it, we need to dismantle it. And whiteness exists in white bodies and in non-white bodies. And so we're, you know, thinking about what are the ways of thinking that promote an unwillingness to see, you know, racism, an avoidance of identifying with a racialized experience for white people. Like, what are the ways that these things play out? And so I'm very, very bold about these concepts in my class. It is not something that is a choice to learn about or not learn about. And I've said this to pre-service teachers, that if you are not thinking about these things, you are not simply ready to teach other people's children. You cannot teach in Ontario schools if you have not seriously thought about settler colonialism and capitalism and white supremacy and cis heteropatriarchy. You cannot teach in Ontario schools without having grappled with these issues at an ideological level, and also your relation to them. What is your social positioning and your social locations? And what might that mean about how you engage teaching and learning, about how you think about education, about experiences that you've had or that will help you understand realities or not? So much of my classes are focused on issues of justice. And so whether I'm teaching a class on social studies or language or math, it is through a lens of intersecting forms of justice. If I'm teaching a class on, you know, in the Masters of Leadership and Community Engagement program, which is one of our graduate programs in the Faculty of Education, a lot of the focus is on how do we think about leadership and community through different lenses. You know, what does it look like through a critical feminist lens? What does it look like through a critical race lens? How are we thinking about, our notions of engagement, our notions of leadership, our notions of policy through various lenses, so that we can challenge the neutrality of these, you know, big fancy terms that mean very different things to very different people? And how can we choose versions of policy and leadership and community engagement that are going to serve those most marginalized in society? So there's a recognition that we cannot, I feel that as educators, we cannot not center these very systems of oppression. They are central to everything and they impact everything. But another part of that is that there's a lot of, my classes tend to be quite emotional in many ways. And we are delving into very personal, very political. The personal is political. You know, we're delving into these parts of ourselves that often don't have expression in the larger world, that we may not be able to speak about in the larger world, that we've not had to think about, you know, if we're privileged in particular areas. And so there are emotions, and some of those emotions are rooted in white fragility and white rage and white tears. And some of those emotions are, you know, a student coming out for the first time in a class. There are a range of experiences. And so to be able to hold that means that we, as educators, I believe, need to try to also create educational spaces that attend to the inner self, that attend to the inner landscapes. You know, as somebody like Parker Palmer might say, how do we attend to the inner landscapes of teachers? And not from a place of, you know, safety is comfort, from a place of always being uncomfortable. My classes tend to be very uncomfortable for many people, but there's a space for inner parts of ourselves to show up. And sometimes it doesn't happen that way, you know, and I don't see that as a sign of failure. I mean, sometimes there are, you know, students that are really upset. There are students that will write things in my course evaluations. There are students that will say things publicly to one another. And I see that as part of the process. There's no way that education can be a place in which we are dismantling structures of whiteness, dismantling structures of settler colonialism without that sort of backlash. That is a necessary part of this process. And so I expect those emotions to be there. I'm very bold in what I say and how I say it. And I let students know, you know, there's going to be a range of emotions, and these are what some of them are. And some of them you're going to need to deal with on your own, because there isn't space in this class for the ways in which emotions can be weaponized and do harm. So, you know, if there's like white rage, or if there's, you know, white fragility that to a degree, I will negotiate that and I will attend to that. And after a while, I will not, because it is those emotions are weaponized against students of color, Black and Indigenous students in particular, to silence them. And I'm not about that. I would say that the environments are fierce. I try to make connections historically to how these things have come to be over time, that this is not something that's happening right now. It's not something that's happening at the individual level. It's happening at the systemic level. It's happened institutionally and intentionally throughout history. And I also try to make space for that inner part of us to emerge. So there's time for reflection in class. There's time for, you know, assignments are often based on some form of inner reflection or thinking about who we are in relation to a particular concept. But it's definitely something that, and it's frustrating at times when, you know, especially racialized educators and oftentimes racialized professors of color are the ones speaking about critical race theory or, you know, critical feminism or various sort of theories that are positioned as, you know, this is not the default. This is not, you know, the theory. And in other courses, folks are just talking about, you know, whatever it might be, but they're not framing it from a particular theoretical lens. And all of a sudden that becomes normalized. And so it's hard and frustrating that it feels like a lot of the burden falls on racialized educators to have to speak to these things, to have to name different theories, different realities, different experiences. And that shows up in a combination of ways. You know, like I have so many students that are in my office that want to talk about what they're experiencing in the classroom, what they're experiencing in the programs, what they're experiencing in their work life or their home life, because we have, you know, as a class, we have collectively created the conditions to go into places that have been silenced for a long time. And so inevitably, there are going to be students that want to speak to this, that want to give voice to this, that want to make sense of this. And so the added burden of this kind of work, matched with, you know, some difficult conversations, some difficult times, some difficult teaching evaluations, all kinds of things. It is not easy work. And it is often not recognized work. And I think that that's something as higher ed institutions, we need to think about and prioritize differently. And we need to, you know, I've talked about this often with regards to feedback, that whether it's a school system getting this feedback from the community, whether it is somebody, a professor getting feedback from students, when that feedback, we have to read that feedback through the lens of white supremacy, through the lens of critical race theory, through these lenses, so that we can understand, you know, what might be driving some of these evaluations, and what information does that give us about how we need to move forward as an institution to continue challenging and dismantling and disrupting settler colonialism, white supremacy, patriarchy, etc.
I've known you now for what, three years through our work with the Equity Knowledge Network. I think so. It's not long enough. I wish I had known you longer. Your work certainly made a difference in the way in which it's provoked me to think about working with community differently, to continue to question my own privileged positionality working at the University of Ottawa, and just the kind of life that I have with our family and the three boys, and the access that they have to, for example, to technology, and be able to touch base with their teachers. So I want to thank you for that. But you know, I also got an amazing opportunity to collaborate and work with you in one way or another on the your York University Faculty of Education Summer Institute. And I thought it was so amazing to attend the first one, which was 2 years ago in August, and then to come back and participate in the second one, and just to see the amazing work that you, Ixil and Carl and Jack and everyone else, I can't mention all of them, their names, but just the amazing work that you're doing in terms of really working with community, school board leaders, educational researchers. And I was just wondering, are you planning on trying to do some sort of institute again this year in light of the current context that we find ourselves? And if so, what is the plan?
For sure. So, I mean, the Summer Institute has been, I think this is its 12th or 13th year now that it's been operating. And It came out of the York Center for Education and Community that was started by Dr. Carl James in the Faculty of Ed at York University. Dr. Sarah Barrett was a big part of that as well. So there's a number of scholars at York whose shoulders I get to stand on, which is such an amazing feeling to walk into a space where these conversations, these structures have been in place for a long time with a group of people that are committed to community, that are committed to educational equity. So I want to just really just take a moment and be grateful that I get to work in a space where so many people, both in the Faculty of Education and outside the Faculty of Education, have allowed for these kinds of structures and ways of thinking and discourses to be in place. And it's been a tremendous amount of work that Carl and others have put into this institute over the years. I was really lucky 3 years ago when I first started with the Summer Institute in the role of co-chair to work with Carl and to work with Jack Negro, who's a superintendent in Kawartha Pine Ridge District School Board, and to work with my co-chair at the time, Ikshel Bennett, who has done amazing things in the Faculty of Ed as well. And, you know, one of the things I think that we love about the program or the Summer Institute so much is that it brings together community and students and teacher candidates and families and educators and district leaders and policymakers. It brings together people from various sectors as well, you know, and I'll talk more about that in a moment, but it brings together people that care about and that have a similar interest in the needs and aspirations and interests of young people, especially young people that have been most marginalized in and by schooling and in and by society. And so, you know, in many ways, the Summer Institute is the place where knowledge is shared, where knowledge is generated, co-created, where we can, you know, try to actually impact curriculum and impact school district policy and in some ways perhaps impact Ministry of Education policies. But it's a place of gathering where people can come together and do some really important thinking and some really important advocating for what needs to happen to create greater educational equity. You know, I think about the idea that there, as we move into the 2020 version of the Summer Institute, you know, this has always been an institute that has been a two-day in-person, you know, end of summer institute as sort of a let's get ready for the new school year. Let's think about this together and differently. And let's recommit to issues of educational equity. And this year will be different because we are probably, you know, not going to be in person for quite some time. So we've decided to take it online. And we're still in sort of the planning phases. And Sultan Rana and Saima Chowdhury are the two co-chairs for the Summer Institute 2020. Because of their leadership, we have been, as a group, thinking about issues of whiteness and white supremacy and anti-racism and how those structures play out in schooling. And this was prior to physical isolation. And now that we are in this space, we're thinking about the intersections of a global quote-unquote crisis that is exacerbating systems like white supremacy, that we are seeing, you know, disproportionate numbers of Black folks and Black students being impacted by COVID, Indigenous students and Indigenous families being impacted by COVID. When we think about that, we're also thinking about, you know, now what does this mean? Where do we need to be vigilant? Where do we need to be thoughtful? Where do we need to, you know, make interventions? What does it mean to move from an understanding of whiteness and white supremacy to action that will change how we decide, you know, make decisions, make policies, create structures or dismantle structures that are furthering disproportionate and disparate incomes, outcomes, for racialized groups of students and Indigenous students. And so we are looking to see how we can turn this into a really engaging online program that recognizes that people have very different living and working experiences right now. So building in lots of flexibility and building in lots of room for choice, different times that things will be aired, making things available after the fact, But trying to be as responsive as we can to the current conditions that many people are finding themselves in, and also thinking about how do we not stop the conversation. This is actually a time where we need to go deeper into the conversation because of the increased impacts, negative impacts it's having on particular groups of people.
Well, thanks for that, Vidya. I just want to thank you for taking the time today to sit with me here on Fook and Conversation. And I hope that as you all plan for August for the Summer Institute, that perhaps you might think of me. And if there's some scholars or community members or teachers or superintendents or students interested in having a conversation, I'd love to host that. Also, we barely got to touch a lot of the big concepts that you take up in your research. So I hope in the coming months that you might be willing to come back on Fook and Conversation and we can have a follow-up, hopefully a follow-up face-to-face. I'll bring my microphone and we can have a conversation around a cup of tea and some toast in person.
I love it, Nick. Oh, it's been such a pleasure. You know, I just love that you are able to blend the humor with the intelligence, with the personality. It's such a pleasure. It's been such a pleasure working with you and such a pleasure being in conversation with you today. And your name has definitely crossed our lips a few times in conversations about Summer Institute. So we will be reaching out for sure. And a cup of tea and some toast sounds wonderful. So I'm totally down for that.
Thank you.